Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, why not reparations? And Richard, as we've seen this real explosion in racial tensions over the past few months, we are once again seeing a debate over the wisdom of reparations for Black Americans. This was taken up recently in the New York Times Magazine by Nicole Hannah-Jones, who is leading their much ballyhooed 1619 project on race. And I thought maybe the way to get to this today, Richard, can we start with some legal theory here? The model proposed here, which is, I suppose, a kind of tort damage for collective misdeeds collectively suffered, in which anyone who could be considered to have been on either side of that equation is now dead. Is this entirely novel? Do we have some legal model that fits this kind of claim?
Well, there is a legal model for trying to figure out how you work to some restitution claims, and there's a model with respect to the tort stuff. So originally, the legal principle was that personal action dies with the person, and that had some fat, fancy Latin translation. And then people realized that this cannot quite be right. So, for example, suppose what happens is, Troy, you decided to kill me, and then I cannot bring an action against you because I'm dead. But most people would say that a wrongful death action would be live for the beneficiaries, for the benefit of my heirs, or some designated groups. That was never created at common law. It was created by statute starting in England in the 1840s. And what you had to do then is to figure out what the measure of damages was, and you had to figure out who were the eligible individuals who could claim it. And slowly these statutes started to expand, but it was always the sense that they had to be somebody who had a pretty direct connection with the person who was killed. That's one side of it. Then on the other side, after you die, the question is whether you can sue the estate of that person to the extent that the assets descended. So if there's an executor or a trustee of the particular estate or an administrator, what happens is they don't have to answer with their personal assets, or otherwise nobody would ever take the job, but you have to be just and pay your debts before you can make your gifts to your beneficiaries. And that was also part of the standard law. Very well circumscribed. There is then another theory having to do with restitution on the theories of unjust enrichment. And suppose what I do is I have to paint your fence. And I did it under conditions of necessity, such that if I did not paint the fence, the entire fence or your house might have been lost. And it turns out there was no contract between us because there was no opportunity to contract. If, in fact, I tried to sue you under restitution, I say, look, I didn't mean this as a gift. You didn't understand it as a gift. And so, therefore, you have to pay me the fair market value of the labor that I've done. And the theory would be that that claim would descend to my heirs should I die, who could bring it in exactly the same way. So it has always been the situation that if you could identify a particular wrongdoer and a particular victim, what you could do is you could trace the descent on both sides. And if it turned out there was a particular benefit that was given to a particular person, you could allow that to descend on both the beneficiary side and in terms of the obligation, but only to the extent that the assets defended. There has never been any particular theory which says that I am Black, you are right, there was slavery, and therefore what happens is everybody who is in this sort of designated group of wrongdoers has to pay everybody who's in the other group. This is a takeoff on a very narrow set of legal theories which bears no relationship to its common law origins.
So there are people, Richard, who would stipulate the kind of legal arguments that you've just made, and yet would say it sort of misses the point. We have to do something, because the argument, I think, would go, we had slavery up until 1865. In the South, anyway, you had a state of, at best, partial freedom for a century to follow until the Civil Rights Act, but largely downstream of the fact that the federal presence in the South during Reconstruction ended up being, all things considered, cut pretty short. So they might say, this is not about compensating people who were enslaved. This is about compensating their descendants who were systematically told for a century that they were free while they were forced to functionally operate with one hand tied behind their back. So they could never build wealth in a comparable way to their white contemporaries. How would you answer that?
Well, I mean, it turns out that it's very, very difficult to make these claims. There's some very highly successful black individuals who overcome all sorts of obstacles. There are many white individuals who are down on their particular luck. It also turns out that the history on this is sort of very, very awkward. It is not as though things under segregation were always worse than they were thereafter. In fact, what you do is, in cases you see a genuine increase in family cohesion and in black wealth that goes through up to, say, about 1965 or so, and then with the rise of the progressive movement, every one of these things starts to turn around. It's very difficult to say that you have to blame everything on Jim Crow when it turns out that much of the sources of all these dislocations is the breakdown of the family, both on the white and the black side, more serious on the black side than on the white side. But if you go back to the 1930s and you look at family structure, black families and white families both had much lower illegitimacy rates. And we do know that illegitimacy is heavily correlated with all sorts of difficulty associated with lack of education, dropping out of school, becoming an illegitimate parent yourself, engaging in abuse of your own particular children, not getting a job. And you can't attribute that to the earlier situations if, in fact, the only immediate trigger that we have for this is a series of progressive policies. So if you start looking at the places in which the situation turns out to be worst, it's cities like Baltimore, which was quite respectable and quite prosperous, even as a segregated city up to about 1950, maybe 1960. Detroit is a similar illustration and so on. So the history just doesn't matter, just doesn't match that particular kind of claim. It's also the situation, who was the people who were doing the oppressing? It certainly wasn't every American citizen. There were certainly people in the South who owned slaves, who basically did sharecropping, who might have gotten a huge advantage. But it's an utter delusion to think that those people, if they were able to treat the independently free people as kind of quasi-chattel slaves in some sense, that they would share that wealth with the rest of the public. In fact, I think it's pretty clear that if you start looking at the subjugation of any particular kind of group or subordination to any other group, what happens is the rest of the government, the rest of the population, is going to be impoverished. There's going to be fewer taxes paid to support the common defense and other kinds of public funds, and individuals who would be more productive in a free market are now basically being reduced to a subordinated status. Everybody else in the system particularly turns out to lose. So the model that somehow or other that all sorts of people who did not own the slaves, did not run the segregation system, were beneficiaries of it, gets it exactly backwards. In fact, these are the kinds of people who were hurt by the loss of talent on that particular kind of side. The only thing that you can do when you get a situation which is this pervasive and this terrible is you have to change the nature of the social institution. And here you'd have to then think about the question, well, what do we think about the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 in terms of sort of paying back some portion of the debt? Well, it doesn't pay back a debt in the literal sense, but it what it tries to do is to increase the set of opportunities that are available to people who are formerly in trouble. Then if you start looking at the construction of these statutes and the emergences of affirmative action programs, diversity programs of one kind or another, how do those fit into this particular situation? There is a peculiar narrative that Hannah Jones starts to engage in which it turns out that the only thing that any white person has ever done is to engage in an act of oppression against black people, whereas in fact, if you start looking at the world, the only reason why we made the advances that we did in the civil rights movement, particularly in the 50s and 60s, is there were many, many people of all races who essentially understood the evils of segregation, understood the evils of Jim Crow, and worked their level hardest in order to overcome those kinds of things. And it's sort of odd to say to their descendants, and now that you've helped so much, what you have to do is you have to pay reparations. Or excuse me, because she says it's not white people who pay reparations, it's the federal government. And she never figures out why or where the federal government is going to get the money to pay those reparations. So it's kind of a fantasy story in which she treats the federal government as an independent source of wealth rather than as a collector of revenues on the one hand and a disperser of those revenues on the other.
What do you make of some of the claims that she makes about today? Because we're now 55 years removed from the Civil Rights Act, but in her telling, there's still a lot of systematic barriers to black progress. So I'll read you something from her piece in which she has just said, yes, cash payments are part of the equation, but then she goes on to say, Reparations should include a commitment to vigorously enforcing existing civil rights prohibitions against housing, educational, and employment discrimination, as well as targeted investments in government-constructed segregated Black communities and the segregated schools that serve a disproportionate number of Black children. Now, I suppose, Richard, implicit in there is the conviction that those existing civil rights laws are not being vigorously enforced. Also, probably worth noting that the use of the word segregated here has subtly moved from referring to de jure segregation, as it does when we're talking about Jim Crow, to de facto segregation, where she's referring to residential or educational communities that are just majority Black. So what's your reaction to this diagnosis of the current state of affairs?
Well, I mean, the first thing you have to ask is whether or not the vigorous enforcement of the laws that she champions actually are going to help people of color. And the answer in many circumstances is no. One of the things that you have to understand is that if there is a minimum wage law or if there is a civil rights law, and you're one of the lucky people who managed to make it over the barrier, you will earn a great deal of money by being in a protected position relative to those people who don't make it over to the barrier and earn essentially little or nothing at all. And so, I mean, one of the things I quoted in the paper was a constant refrain of Walter Williams, which is 1948 at the height of segregation, it turns out that the Black and white unemployment rates are about the same. And this is true even though the skill levels of the two groups happen to be somewhat different. The way the market equilibrated under those circumstances is it allowed Black workers to bid at lower wages than whites, which meant that they could get on the thing. And once you get on a system and in it, you can then get promotions within the framework. If you're kept out of it because of a minimum wage barrier, it not only influences your prospects at the time that you wish to be hired when you're 15, 16, or 17, it essentially deprives you of the social skills that you need in order to advance after you're in your 20s or even in your 30s. One of the great mistakes with something like the minimum wage law is it simply does not understand what the value of a job is to most people, including people who are relatively poor. And the job is not just a wage, it's a source of education, an education in learning a skill. And sometimes these skills are apprenticeship skills, which allow you to get a job as an electrician or a plumber, but also it teaches you a lot of social skills. Teaches you how to interact with people, how to work for somebody else, how to cooperate with other people, how to follow instructions, how to basically talk with customers. All of these sort of soft skills are immensely important in developing relationships with other people. And if you are cut off from the market because you can't get a wage, then you're not going to get those things. So what you do is you say, oh, what we want to do is to really raise the wage because that's the one thing that matters. It isn't the one thing that matters. How do we know this? Well, there are many kids, some of whom are privileged, which some of less so, who take summer internships in which they essentially work for zero wages. Does that mean they're getting nothing out of this? Well, of course not. What it means is they understand that the opportunity to participate in and to observe what's going on in a successful enterprise is going to give them lots of skills that they could then take somewhere else. And in some cases, if they do a good job, they will be hired after a probationary period of one kind or another in the very firm for which they intern. So it turns out that, you know, being able to bid low in order to get on the ferry and then allow you to leave the dock and to continue to move with everybody else is perhaps the most valuable thing that you can get out of these kinds of positions. I myself took jobs which paid me absolutely nothing, and the benefits that I remember 50 years later, 60 years later, I guess it is now, are the benefits that come from the fact that I really watched institutions and how they operated from the inside, and it was the fund of knowledge that drove everything under these circumstances. So you don't want to treat those things as appropriate. And then, I mean, the whole question about segregation is, again, also extremely difficult. One of the things that we know about neighborhoods and so forth is that even if you remove the law, there tends to be a kind of a separation that starts to develop. And there was a very famous article written about the so-called checkerboard. And the question is, you now have a group of individuals, and each of them would like to live in an integrated society in which 60% of the people identified with the same group that they were in, and 40% say identified with the other group. Well, if everybody from both groups wants to do this, it turns out it can't happen, given the fact that each person has eight neighbors on the checkerboard, let us say. And so what you do is you tend to get a line in the middle, which says there's a one color and then there's another color on the other side of that line. And this is just a simple matter about the way in which these period dynamics work. And so what you want to do in order to help these communities work is to get a whole series of secondary organizations that aren't territorially based, clubs, teams, all sorts of activities like that. And if you can run those things on a voluntary basis, you can get yourself some kind of really effective integration, whether it be on grounds of race or sex or age or anything else. So what you really want to do is not to encourage government mandates of the kind that is suggested here. What you really want to do is to get voluntary organizations who are really very, very good in trying to figure out how it is that you bridge these gaps through cooperative arrangements. The difficulty of Hannah Jones's situation is it's all coercion. And what that's going to do is to breed a real backlash against individuals. So when I wrote my Hoover column, you know, you start seeing the comments that come up afterwards, and many of them are just downright indignant. You know, my ancestor lost his life in the Civil War trying to free the slaves. I am now a person who owes reparations. I mean, you know, these are fair questions to start to answer. And I always regarded the reparations great debate is highly divisive. To me, I don't think there's any system of compensation that makes the slightest bit of sense. What you really need going forward is to develop cooperation. In order to get cooperation, you need to develop trust. And you're not going to be able to develop trust if you see things that are going to be easily construed in an accusatorial fashion. So my view is that everybody who wants to improve racial relations should back off this particular topic and try to figure out what we can do to improve these kinds of things going forward. And there's enough difficulty on that issue, to put it mildly, given, you know, the whole question of what counts as proof of discrimination. Do you have to show intent? Do you have to show that there's discrimination with respect to a group of eligible candidates, i.e. PhDs in mathematics for certain times? Or is the baseline for discrimination a difference between the profession or the members of any given occupation or profession and the general population, which is an untenable definition? There are all sorts of terrible difficulties that we have. But part of the problem now is, if anything, is that black achievement rates in school are perhaps lower than they were 60 or 70 years ago. And you have to then ask yourself, what is it that we're doing wrong? And here's just one little suggestion. You start looking at charter schools like the Success Academy. They do extremely well with minority kids under a system of real strict discipline. You look at public schools like Minnesota and Minneapolis, which is broken down. Essentially, they refuse to enforce the disciplinary codes against minority kids who get into trouble because they say it's a disparate impact unless you punish the same number of white kids proportionate to the population as black kids. And Minnesota and Minneapolis, of course, is one of the places that started to blow up. Seattle is another. It has to be a source of concern that the most progressive communities seem to have the worst race relation. And I don't think it's an accident. I think what you have to do with everybody, white, black, or green, is to run an education system is not to be the victim of low expectations. You have to demand a great being of all these students, and you have to reward them when they achieve it, and you have to essentially gently chastise them when they do not. And I don't see anything whatsoever in what Hannah Jones writes, which is designed to say, look, people, you too, we too, everybody is to some extent responsible for their own behavior and their own success. You have to be able to take control over your own life, and that means you have to be prepared to engage in activities that require deferred gratification. It's the only road for success. Education requires investment, and only after the investment is made can you get a return. If you try to get the return without the investment, it's just going to create all sorts of dislocations and disappointments.
Final question that I'll pose to you, Richard. I give this to you to do what you will with it. Because we usually talk about specific substantive legal or policy questions. I'm just going to give you the broader cultural one, which is, what do you make of this moment? There is clearly a radical sentiment on the wind that individuals have to be toppled, that institutions have to be toppled, that in many cases, the history has to be toppled. And there are people who say that this is a brush fire that's going to burn itself out. And there are people who say it's going to become a conflagration that's going to take down everything in its path. Where are you on that question?
I wish I knew. I know that I regard the trends as very ominous, and I know why I regard them as ominous. It seems to me that when you start looking at the past, there are two ways in which you can judge it. One is you could try to figure out what your current standards are today and to hold everybody who does not meet those standards 100 or 200 years ago as being morally derelict in one particular situation. That means if you take somebody who was trying to abolish slavery in 1780, but did not believe in the full voting rights of all Black individuals at the time, that they would be regarded as a moral retrograde, when in their own particular period they engaged in heroic activities which were intended to, in fact, improve the lots of a group of individuals who were unfairly discriminated against and terribly treated. My view about it is you can't do that. When you're trying to talk about these things, you can say, okay, we wish they had done more, we wish they had done it faster. But I don't think you could start to say for the individuals who put themselves at risk in order to improve the lot of their fellow citizens, that they should be treated with all sorts of opprobrium. And the second thing I think that one has to say is not only do you have to worry about this proportionality offense, you have to make sure you know whom you're going to target. And so there's so many people whose statues get toppled and burned because people have no idea of who they are. And it's also a sense of extra sensitivity. So you don't want to read people in the way in which they make their statements. You want to read them in the worst possible light, which is, I think, also a mistake. There is the famous incident with Ellen Futter before the Museum of Natural History. And in front of the museum, there was a picture of T.R., Teddy Roosevelt, a great man, by all accounts, on horseback, and on this one side he was flanked by a Native American Indian, on the other flanked by a Black African. And the whole point of this particular thing was to show that Roosevelt, although he was somebody who came from superior circumstances, really embraced the community of brotherhood across two continents. And that was the message that was created and intended. And now it's read, well, he's on a horseback and everybody else is not. So this is an abject form of cultural imperialism. I don't think you want to read back into modern statutes behavior of that sort. Maybe today, if you did another statue, you would not do it in the same way. But I think to simply wipe out all of our history, instead of saying, here's something that we have to talk about, here's something we have to share, I think it's much more a sensible way to engage in dialogue over things that you think are somewhat objectionable, rather than to simply say, I'm so right about all this stuff, I'm going to wipe it off the face of the earth and feel the better for it. The material conditions of life will not depend on how these statutes stand or fall. Our cultural history may well depend upon that. But if individuals want to succeed in this world, there is only one way in which they can do that, and that's through focus and hard work. If somebody believes that discrimination is so great that they can't possibly succeed, they're going to fail. If somebody were prepared to say, oh, I know that the deck is stacked a little bit against me, I have to work a little bit harder, oddly enough, that person will do much better. And, you know, I've had a pretty blessed life under these circumstances, and I'm not trying to complain. But it seems to me, even when I reflect upon myself, I know many people who were also born in rather favorable circumstances who made a mess of things because they simply didn't want to focus. Character is what essentially counts the most, and it can overcome inferiority in position, station, and wealth. And I think that's the message you want to give to people. If you work, you can succeed. We want to talk about opportunities, and we want to talk about personal virtues in some sense or another, drive, focus, ambition, and so forth. We don't want to talk about all the things that make us appear as though we're just helsom, flotsam, and jetsam on a sea of social injustice. What you do when you take that position is you will create the very conditions you're trying to avoid. A defeated group which regards itself as constantly aggrieved. What we want to do is to have citizens who are more promising, more upright, more determined to do well, rather than to people who simply say that the yoke of racism is so great that they are going to be defeated no matter how hard they work. So I really think that character in its formation is the essential element to success on all of these issues.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening. This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.